Today's guest on the SCADI podcast is Robin Henry, who is the head of dispute resolution of Collier Bristow. With Robin's help, we take a look at structured credit disputes, including convertible bonds, who the parties are, and how disputes typically arise.
I'm joined today by Robin Henry, who's head of litigation from Collier Bristow. Very, very pleased to welcome you to the SCADI podcast, Robin.
Hi, Nick. Yes, I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So we are touching on a bit of a specialist subject for me anyway, convertible bonds, but we want to do this from a very different perspective. And I thought it'd be great to have you come in and talk to us from a litigation perspective, because when we think about SCADI's business, we have our audit and controls business when we're really looking at, you know, how we can prevent problems from happening, the kind of pre-problem position, if you like, the stream. Then we have the investigations business where, you know, problems are starting to be uncovered and looked into. And then, of course, we have the expert witness side of things when we're asked to come in and help when a dispute has arisen and needs to be resolved. And I think your position is very interesting because obviously you're a head of litigation now at a law firm, but you were also previously in-house in a bank. You were in Morgan Stanley, weren't you?
Yeah, I was. This is when I was at Simmons & Simmons City Law Firm, but I was on secondment at Morgan Stanley for a while. And that was just a very interesting experience. And the reason I was there was because it was part of the work we were doing on the Lehman collapse. So there was all sorts of interesting distressed debt and structured products issues to be dealt with. And I've always had an interest in that before and since then in finance and specifically on structured products.
Yeah. So, you know, the matter in hand, and I don't mind if we broaden this discussion, you know, to wider, you know, wider issues rather than specifically on convertible bonds, because, you know, it's all good material. But, you know, when a convertible bond dispute arises and someone comes in to see you at Collier Bristow, if they indeed do come in, it probably sounds a bit archaic, they probably send you an email. But anyway, when they approach you, what are your thoughts? What do you think when you see a convertible bond dispute looming over the horizon or someone approaches you with that?
I think, well, first of all, it doesn't have to be a convertible bond dispute, but let's start with a basic bond dispute. You need to think about who are the person involved. Where do they fit in the bond structure? Are they on the side of the originator, the bank, the issuer, the trustee? I had a dispute involving bondholders, which was against a collateral manager. So there's all these different players involved. They all have their different roles, and they all have different rights, legal rights and obligations, which clearly, or sometimes less than clearly, set out in the bond documentation. So the first thing that we would go to, any lawyer would go to, is the documentation. So looking at, you know, the security deed, all the other documentation that shows what rights people have in the structure.
I love it. Right. I've got you here. You're captive to me. I'm going to start asking some value questions. So as an ex-trader and also an originator, so indenture versus offering circular.
Yeah.
What can you tell our listeners about those in terms of the differences thereof?
Well, an offering circular, I mean, is very much a, you know, it's the offer to the bondholders, right? It's saying this is what it is. I mean, I'm right in thinking that sometimes it's public, sometimes it's private.
Yeah. I'm very used to seeing offering circulars. Not very used to seeing indentures.
Right. Okay. So the indentures are very much they're not always called indentures. Sometimes, you know, they'll be given other names. But essentially, it's the terms and conditions of the bonds. And that will be one thing. And it will refer to other participants in the structure. For example, one of the most important ones being the trustee.
Right.
And the trustee will have a security deed, and that will set out what the trustee's rights and obligations are. And then there will be other participants who will also have their own agreements. And it's you're putting together a jigsaw of those different agreements. And that's all kind of in the background. And very often, I think, people who are thinking of buying bonds are thinking about the financial side of things and not necessarily thinking about the legal obligations. We were acting for a bondholder recently who had been instrumental in setting up a bond issuance program. And he took a tranche of bonds, and he was looking at it when things went wrong for him recently in the structure. It didn't go the way he was expecting. He was looking at it from the point of view of, this isn't supposed to happen because it's not the way it's supposed to happen in the market. But we're looking at it from the side, yeah, but we need to look at it in terms of what do the documents actually say,
yeah,
from a legal point of view.
So documentation,
yeah,
I'm getting very loud and clear, is very, very important, right? Yeah. And I always say this to people, like, you know, convertible bonds, typically you're looking at 250 pages of risk. You know, that's what is in that prospectus. And when I was trading, you know, a lot of my time, when I wasn't just saying, you know, 3/8, 5/8, I might trade at half, I was actually reading documents just to try and make sure we understood,
yeah,
any potential pitfalls.
Yeah.
You know, because you as a market maker, you could be making, I don't know, in Asia, you could be making 120 bonds at any time. And to have, you know, knowledge of all of those clauses within all of those bonds, very, very difficult. So yeah, a good read through was definitely part of the job.
Yeah, that's right. I think very often traders think about things in terms of market standards. This is the way things are done. And I remember there's one specific case where a judge was dealing with a case that involved, you know, some kind of structured product and a dispute over it. And, you know, people were putting in affidavits and saying, this is the market standard. This is how the market standard works. And the judge wasn't having any of it. He just said, I don't care about market standard. It doesn't mean anything. It's meaningless. Let's look at what the documents say. And that's a very important lesson for people to think about.
That's really a really interesting perspective, because certainly I've been on different cases where sometimes that viewpoint has held, and other times actually the practitioner position has held stronger, largely because in that particular case it did result from an error in the documentation.
Yep.
You know, that would be the Aristocrat case, which we might get on into in a while. But so, I mean, really, what I think you're talking about now is really, you know, in a dispute, what are the pitfalls for a bondholder?
Yeah.
And you're describing.
Yeah, and I think when specifically you started off talking about convertible bonds, and I think what's interesting about them is that they inevitably introduce another layer of complexity into the bonds, because they're not just bonds; they can become something else. They can become shares. And the process whereby they become shares is, you know, determined by the decisions made by either the issuer or the bondholder, and also by the levels at which, you know, the bonds themselves are trading or the shares are trading. So you're immediately into a level of complexity there, and complexity inevitably brings the possibility of disputes as to what's actually supposed to happen in any particular situation. So I think that's why convertible bonds become more interesting in terms of the possibility of disputes and why they might land up on desk.
Yeah, and it is funny, because also there's been a lot of evolution in the time that I've been looking at the product, which is, you know, frighteningly getting on for 30 years now. But you sort of think about the journey and some of the protections, you know, like the sort of the takeover protections, but also thinking much more about things like the dividend protection, where, you know, convertible bondholders were sort of feeling like they were missing out on some of the equity benefits, for example. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that can be full pass-through, which is very easy, or it can be a threshold pass-through where dividends have to reach a certain point, and then beyond that, bondholders get paid. And of course, all of this lends itself to misinterpretation, misunderstanding. And I think that's probably, you know, some of the areas where, you know, it's interesting from an issuer point of view, because if you think of the bondholders, it's kind of their day job, if you like.
Yeah.
They're dealing in these instruments day in, day out. They're real practitioners. Whereas on the issuer side, it's a very different perspective, isn't it? In terms of how often they might choose to issue this versus a range of other financing possibilities they might have.
Yeah, I think there's been a recent rise in the issuance of convertible bonds for sort of economic reasons due to the rise of interest rates. And that's very important in terms of you'll get cycles of when they become popular or less popular. I think issuers need to think as carefully as bondholders, though, in terms of building in those protections for themselves so much as they can, or avoiding pitfalls for things going wrong when a decision is made to, you know, redeem those bonds if they can, if that's what they want to do.
Yeah, interesting. So, I mean, well, actually, before we move on to the kind of disputes that you might have seen, there's something I did want to just pick up on, and obviously you've really stressed, and I think it's right, the importance of documentation. And I wonder, Robin, about how convertible bonds are issued in terms of the issue process, whether that contributes to the likelihood of disputes. So what I'm talking about is in the public market, it's very much an accelerated book build where people are contacted late at night after the market shut because they don't want the issue. The lead manager doesn't want any impact on the stock. They want to be able to price this thing, get it out, allocate it, and then they can start trading it. And of course, we've talked about 250 pages of potential clauses and risk, which no one can read before an accelerated book build. So effectively, what you're often given is a summary term sheet with the kind of the key points, and off you go. And then the other side of things is on the private side of issuance, that's a much more negotiated putting together of a transaction. Because, of course, you're directly lending to someone, and if you're a party to that, you really have a hand in writing some of those clauses. And so it's a kind of a different side of how disputes can arise.
So I've got that leads me to ask you a question. Given that that is the case, is it the case that public issuances of convertible bonds tend to be simpler in terms of their, you know, provisions in relation to conversion, as opposed to private? Do they get much more complicated for private ones?
I would say they do, because I think, and this is where it gets interesting in terms of some of the disputes you might see and you might have seen, is that if you look at the public market, it's pretty much as standardized as you can get it to be. I.e., you know, they will have some kind of coupon, some kind of premium, probably some kind of early redemption clause. And, it, you know, we're expecting, you know, 5-year paper, but with a put in year 3, for example, would be quite standard.
Yeah.
The call terms are all pretty standard, the issuer's call, that kind of stuff. The bells and whistles come in things like the dividend protection that we've talked about. What kind of takeover protection could it be? Could it be a ratchet where, you know, there's a kick to the conversion price, or is it just simply a change of control put?
Well, all of those things can potentially lead to disputes. But obviously, if you start building in bespoke clauses, negotiated clauses, then you are, A, making it, you know, less standardized, less attractive to anybody who wants to get into that market. But also you are making it potentially more likely to result in a dispute, not because people aren't putting the effort into, you know, those bespoke terms, but just simply because they're not standardized. You know, you've got ISDA agreements or something, which if they make a change to the ISDA agreement, they that's years worth of committees poring over the possibilities of, you know, what is, you know, changing it going to make. And they try and make sure they've thought of everything. Now, if you're doing a one-off deal, you'll be working from your own experience, but you may not be able to, you know, nail everything down. So, I can see that the private issuances can be much more likely to end up in a dispute.
Yeah, they are. And it's interesting too, though, because, of course, on the former, the public, you know, the chances of the lead banker or his junior, her junior, putting together an offering circular based on a template of another issue, and therefore then there are, you know, Scrivener type errors and so on that creep in. You can see how that can occur. And I see enough of those kind of errors on prospectuses to realise that that is a real risk. Yeah. But actually, in of themselves, I mean, if someone came to you with a Scrivener's error, you probably wouldn't. I don't know. What would your reaction be? What would you think? As a bondholder, probably. Well, it could be as an issuer, I suppose. I might come to you and say there's a Scrivener's error.
It's something where you would. There's obviously an opportunity. Let's say a bondholder's come to us with a Scrivener's error, which they say is, you know, in their favour, and they're going to make millions of pounds as a result of that error. You see that as a potential opportunity, but it has to be quite seriously tested. You're not automatically going to think, yeah, this is great. You're going to get some big payout on this one, because clearly there will then need to be a sort of process of going through, well, who knew what at the time the contract was entered into? Is there any other sort of discussions beforehand, which quite clearly said, you know, X is X, it's not Y equals Y that has been put into the document. But it might go the other way. It might be that, you know, we entered into negotiations, we were always told it was going to be this, and it's there in the contract, and it's too late for the other side to turn around and say, oh, we didn't mean that. You know, that's their fault. So it can work, and it should be taken seriously. But part of it is, does it actually make sense? I mean, there's one thing where you've put the wrong exchange rate in, and maybe that's going to go against you because it's just a plain mistake and would work. The contract would work with that mistake in it. But you might have other situations, and we had one. This was where there was a dispute between the bondholders and the collateral manager as to whether on a early redemption, the collateral manager was entitled to a $15 million fee. And they said, well, clearly we are, because it says that's what we would get on maturity. But then you actually look down, well, there's a different waterfall applying earlier in the early redemption. And there's no mention of a fee. Now, clearly the collateral manager did not intend for that to be the case. But we took that to the Court of Appeal, and they agreed with our clients, which said, no, the collateral manager has to pay up. Or, misses out on that $15 million. So, and that was, I mean, it wasn't a straightforward error, but it was something which was missing from the contract, which they would otherwise have put in had it been pointed out to them.
Yeah.
So it was an omission to that extent. Yes. So
often it can be, you know, not just what is said in a contract, but what is omitted.
Yep.
And so on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's really interesting. And certainly, you know, we've talked on this podcast before, you know, Damien and myself, you know, looking back at situations where we've had, you know, valuation disputes and the mechanism doesn't work, you know, for the particular instruments that are part of the contract, for example.
Well, then you're in a situation, you might be in a situation where, let's say, both sides say, you know, there's a mechanics here and there's a bit missing. It doesn't actually work. It can't be done. It's not feasible. At that point, the court can imply a term into the contract and say it was quite clear that the process was supposed to include this bit to allow it to work, and we will, you know, we'll insert that to make sure that the contract actually works as people intended it to happen. So that's another situation where, again, it's an omission, but it can be corrected. The court will correct it as long as it's to ensure the efficacy of the contract itself.
Yeah. And are you looking at the Credit Suisse situation, the 81s?
Yeah, that's interesting. So these 81 bonds, they're called COCO bonds, which is contingent convertible bonds. So basically they're saying that they're bonds which can be converted into equity on certain contingencies. And one of those contingencies, and I don't know the exact wording of the Credit Suisse bonds, but effectively it says one of those contingencies is if the Swiss regulator decides that for reasons of financial stability or the efficiency of the market, it's going to convert those into equity. And I think it was clearly understood, or should have been understood, by people who were buying those kind of bonds, because they've been around for a long time, certainly since the financial crisis. They should have understood that there were serious risks that such a trigger event could happen without their involvement at all, and even without the bank's involvement. So when Credit Suisse was bought up by UBS, and the only way that FINMA, the Swiss regulators, said that could happen was if those bonds were effectively demoted. So they were, and the interesting thing is, not only were they demoted to the level of shareholders, they were demoted below the level of shareholders. So while shareholders received, I think, something like 3% of value or something, the these 81 bondholders got nothing. So really quite a dramatic shift, because obviously as debt holders, they would have ranked above shareholders, and now they're ranking below the shareholders. So I'm not surprised they're annoyed as to what happened. But there were risks. I think they would have appreciated risks. They obviously were high-yielding bonds because of that risk. But this is going to result in huge litigation in Switzerland as to what the powers of the regulator were, whether they could do it, and whether the terms, and we're back to the terms of the bonds again, whether the specific terms of the bonds allowed for this contingency to happen.
It is an interesting one, that, because as you point out, there's this, you know, massive juniorization that's occurred, and yeah, you might have it in the documentation, but I think, you know, just with my kind of trader's practitioner's hat on, you know, I'm sat there buying bonds, thinking I'm good, I'm well ahead of equity,
yeah.
So it's an interesting. It will be one to watch, won't it? It will be very interesting.
It will be, and I think there were concerns in the immediate aftermath that this would have, you know, a knock-on of systemic effect on other banks. Because the whole point of these type of bonds initially was to allow banks to raise this kind of, you know, safety buffer capital, which would be a first loss on insolvency, but at you know, cheaper than actually getting more shareholders. Or issue more shares to them. So there was a reason after the financial crisis why these bonds were being issued. And so I think there was concern that the value of Deutsche's similar convertible contingent bonds went down considerably after Credit Suisse was bought by UBS. But the latest I've heard is that, you know, the market for these type of bonds is back up and very buoyant again. So people have very short memories, and that's up to them. But they are, you know, those risks are still there.
It's so true about people's memories. I do find that greed overcomes the
greed and fear.
The memory, yes, very, very quickly in the financial markets, but much more quicker. Because I also enjoy the very forthright attitude of people at the time, but I will never, you know, lend money again. But I have seen situations where actually people have stuck to their guns, and I don't know if you saw the action in this Chinese name XJ International in the past week, where you know, this is an issuer that provides education services in China, and it would seem that they actually have funds to pay back a put. The bondholders have attempted to put the bonds, but they are not, even though they're sitting on, I think, the outstanding is something like $315 million, and they have, you know, cash and equivalents to be able to pay that back. They're choosing not to, let's say. And that's a situation where I really can foresee bondholders being very careful and repricing China risk as a result, and probably demanding different kinds of terms going forward from the market for the issuance of bonds.
Yeah, I think that is obviously the risk of a Credit Suisse situation. You know, I'm sure at the time the Swiss regulator were thinking, we have no choice. You know, this is a situation, we can't let, you know, Credit Suisse just collapse completely. They forced UBS to buy it. It was one of those panic situations. We'll deal with the fallout later. But I think, you know, there must be questions now in terms of the fallout. Is what effect does that have in Switzerland and other places on that market? That's the risk, is that you cross the line, or maybe cross the line. You know, there was certainly a bold move by the regulator to convert those bonds. And that's clearly, you know, if people don't do what they're supposed to do legally, or they default, or, you know, they get into disputes, there is obviously that effect on people's market decisions.
And in those particular bonds, I mean, we talk about bondholders, and often we can think of bondholders from a very kind of institutional wholesale perspective. But I think in the case of the Credit Suisse AT1 bonds, it seems to me that rather a lot has been sold into Asia and into smaller investors, retail type investors, who are now the bondholders on these. What are the kind of ramifications for disputes that would involve those kinds of parties, as opposed to the much more institutional type of bondholders that we might think of?
Well, I suppose the biggest issue is that very often what bondholders can do is determined by voting rights. So if you've got voting rights where, you know, you've got an institution which holds over 75% of the bonds in a particular tranche, then they may well have the power to go ahead and make decisions. If you've got the minority bondholders, or those bondholders that are a really disparate group, then the chances of them being able to take coordinated action is that much reduced.
Right. Yeah.
So that's another thing that people should think about, is not only what their voting rights are in a particular tranche, but where they are in the structure. So the lower down you are in the structure, obviously, the more beholden you are to people above you in the structure, and that can mean the difference between, you know, getting your position wiped out, losing everything, and not. So that's again, it's the ability to think ahead and think what might happen in all the different possible situations. And perhaps that's too difficult, but you need to think about, it's all about risk, isn't it? You need to think about what risks am I taking on? Clearly, if you are in that sort of, you know, one of the lower tranches of a bond structure, then clearly you should be aware of that. You may be getting a reward in the short term for high coupon payments, but it's, in the end, it may all turn wrong.
Yeah.
But then, you know, it's all about risk.
Yeah. And I guess a sort of, it might even be a kind of final question, really, but I'm interested as to what's the court's attitude to bondholders and issuers coming to them with a dispute, i.e., you know, are they very receptive, or is there really, you know, are there points where they might just be displeased that everyone hasn't sorted this all out before? I mean, it's a bit of a, you know, woolly question.
No,
but,
no, it's an interesting.
But as a
no,
kind of
it's
non-practitioner,
an
I'm always interested in that, about what, how these things are received.
What's interesting, again, you're back to kind of people's different roles in, and I've had different experiences where, let's say, one experience. This is the collateral manager dispute. So you've got two participants in the structure who have different views as to who gets paid what. And you've got the trustee in the middle who has the decision as to how to operate the waterfall and what payments to make. And so the trustee says, well, look, I'm just a trustee corporation. We're not getting involved in this. We don't want to make any decision where we get sued for taking the wrong decision. So we're going off to the court and we're going to ask for a declaration as to what is the right thing to do. And that's, I think everybody's happy with that situation because, you know, both sides say, okay, let's go off. We'll get, you know, we've got a neutral party, the trustee, who is technically bringing the action. But we're just asking, again, neutral, objective participant, the court, to decide who's right and who's wrong. On the other hand, you can have a situation where bondholders, they want to take action. Let's say, you know, an event of default has been called and they want to take action and they appeal to the trustee and they say, we don't think this is correct. This isn't supposed to happen under the terms of the bond. And the trustee, and I've had experience with this, the trustee saying, but we've had instructions from, you know, the bondholders in tranche A, you're in tranche B, we've had instructions. We're allowed, look at the document, says they, if a majority of them tell the trustee to do something, we have to do it.
Right.
And in that case, the trustee, well, we said to the trustee, oh, well, this is obviously a case you have to ask the court. And they said, no, we're not going to do that, which slightly surprised me because I tend to think of trustees as so scared they won't take any decisions. But in this case, they were very much, no, it's quite clear to us. We have been given instructions. We can't do anything else. And we are going to go ahead and comply with those instructions. And that may be tough on other people in the structure. So I think the point I would mention there is that bondholders need to be aware that their rights are often very severely constrained by the terms of the bond. So, you know, they can't take any action unless 75% of a particular class have decided something. They can't sue the issuer because the issuer is insolvency remote. It's only a tiny little company in the BVI or the Cayman Islands or somewhere which doesn't do anything apart from, you know, issue notices in a very technical and formal way. So there's no one to sue there, and you're not allowed to sue them anyway. And then you can't sue the trustee because they've got the... You look at it and it says, who has the power to sue anybody under the structure? Oh, it's the trustee. You've delegated your rights to them. So again, and there may be perfectly practical commercial reasons why that is done. Otherwise, you know, every time you issued a bond, there'd be just a massive bonfire of everybody trying to sue everybody else. So it's very restrictive over who can actually take legal action. And sometimes they don't want to take legal action.
Yeah.
So,
well, I think it's very timely, Robin, having you on the SCADI podcast, because we've obviously got a slew of issuance. And I know some of those last comments were probably a little bit wider than convertible bonds, but it's absolutely the case that when there's a bonanza and people start getting a bit of FOMO and they're worried about missing on the next deal, it's trading up in the grey, they don't read the docs, and it's only when the music stops that people start to find out. So I think there's some really good advice in there to avoid getting into hot water, because, as we know, litigation can be expensive, it can be lengthy.
It can. No, it can be very expensive, very enough, not going to lie. So, you want to try and avoid it if at all possible.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, Rob, you've survived the SCADI podcast, so we have a little thank you for you. We have your I've survived the SCADI podcast mug, and a copy of Moneyland by Oliver Buller. Have you read that?
No, I haven't, and I do love a good financial drama.
It's a great read. It's a really great read. We love it. It's a particular favourite. If you've enjoyed the Scardy podcast, and you always enjoy the Scardy podcast, you may consider joining the Scardy Discord, which is Scardy's chat community, where you can explore many of the topics that we have, the background materials ahead of podcasts. Hey, if we even get Robin to join, you might even be able to pose a few questions to Robin in your own time as well. Although I'm sure he'd much rather you contacted him formally, where he can sign an agreement and collect some fees.
Thanks very much for that plug. Yes.
Robin, you've been very generous with your time. I've really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you.
No, it's a pleasure. A pleasure to come down and see you.